This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Equal justice under the law is one of our founding principles, but it is a principle that is often violated in practice. In particular, people who can't afford good legal help are at a disadvantage. In criminal cases, the court appoints an attorney. But what happens when you can't afford an attorney and you're facing a divorce or child custody or medical claims? Well, there are services that provide legal counsel. Here we have Legal Aid of North Carolina, for instance. But legal aid has been seriously hurt with federal budget cuts and growing demand. What are the challenges of getting legal access throughout our state? Gene Nicholas here. He's a professor and the director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the University of North Carolina Law School. Welcome, Gene. Good to have you.
Nice to be here, Frank.
Charles Holton is here as well, chair of the Board of Directors of Legal Aid North Carolina and an attorney with Womble Carlyle. Charles Holton, welcome to you. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us is Ashley Quinones. She is a client of Legal Aid North Carolina. Ashley, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to start with you. A few years ago, you found yourself in need of legal help. Tell me what happened.
I am a recipient of a double lung or bilateral lung transplant, and I had that in 2001. The medications that I take to keep my lungs from rejection placed me in renal failure in 2009. In 2010, I was officially listed to be on the transplant list for a kidney transplant. A few months later, I received a letter from Medicaid saying that they had rejected my claim for the kidney transplant.
So how did legal aid help you?
Well, when I read through the letter, there were several different reasons that they were rejecting the claim, that they were giving me a denial. And at first, I didn't know what to do. So my first reaction, of course, was really just to cry it out. So I called my sister, actually, in tears, saying, you know, I don't know what to do. I'm going to die. That's it. And she said, you know, you've fought bigger battles. Are you going to lay down and take this? Or are you going to fight this one too? And it gave me some empowerment. So I was like, you're right. I'm going to fight this. So then I reread the letter and read it with a clearer mind. And at the bottom, when it mentioned appealing the denial, there were different options for an appeal. I checked the box to appeal, and then it asked if I would be representing myself, if I would have a lawyer, or if I was being represented by legal aid. Not knowing what legal aid was, I took to Google and researched it, realized that it was not only my best option, but at that point, because of the level of disease I was going through and my income, my only option. So I called and set up an appointment to meet with someone to fill out the paperwork and decide whether or not I would be eligible as a client.
And what were the reasons they denied the claim?
There were several reasons. They had actually gone, when I had my double lung transplant, I was 18 or 19 when I was originally evaluated. So my whole history with my disease and how I'd coped with my disease had been in pediatrics. And I was your very, very normal, typical teenager when it comes to those kind of things. I went through a rebellious stage and for a short period of time was non-compliant. That was when I was, I believe, 16 or 17. So that was mentioned as far as my lung transplant went, and it was actually became an issue in getting the lungs as well, but that's the past. So when they went through and were looking at my kidney transplant evaluation, they actually went back to those pediatric records, and they denied me on the basis that I had a history of noncompliance. At the time that I was listed for transplant, I was 29 years old, so they went back to when I was 16, and said that I was non-compliant, I would not take care of the organ, that I had a psychosocial and psychological history, that I needed better caretakers, and that I was not physically capable of handling the actual kidney because of my lung complications. They did not want to give me a kidney when my lungs were not good enough to handle the operation, and the kidney would last longer than the lungs.
So this is a very complicated case. It has all kinds of medical complications that you're going to have to explain, and it's going to have to be explained
Absolutely.
In a legal context.
Yes, sir.
And so you check legal aid. Charles Holton, save us the Google search. What did, or tell us what Ashley found when she Googled legal aid.
There are lawyers with legal aid who have been trained and are experienced in working on benefits matters, typically federal benefits of all kinds. And they can step in and first give guidance to patients who are having issues with regard to coverage and things like that. And then secondly, when there's the need for an appeal, to actually handle it for them, as was done in this case.
And how long, I mean, and one of the things I would think a legal aid attorney or any attorney would do is assess how long this is going to take. Well, how big a project is this, right?
Absolutely. And some of them can go on for years.
So in taking, first of all, give us a sense of how many people are eligible, what the need is, and how much of that need can be satisfied by legal aid.
In North Carolina, there are over 2 million citizens now who are probably eligible for legal aid services. Legal aid has 122 lawyers stretched out over 20 offices across the state. That's obviously a very low amount of coverage that's available, and so they have to prioritize certain things and focus their efforts in certain ways.
So what percentage of the need do you think is met?
No more than 50%, if that. There are other ways. Private lawyers help out through their pro bono efforts. There are lots of clinic efforts that legal aid puts on to try to enable citizens to handle matters for themselves where that's possible. That's often not the most desirable way to do it, but that can certainly help. But there's a great deal of unmet need.
Gene, how has that changed, or has it changed over time in terms of the unmet need for legal services?
Well, in the United States, the unmet need for legal services has been massive for generations. There's been a larger gulf between what we put on our courthouse walls in this country than in the leading industrial nations, the leading democracies. So we have said, broadly speaking, for at least a generation that something approaching 80% of the legal need of the poor and the near poor is unmet in the United States. You were right to point out that there's a difference between our civil system and our criminal system on that front, where on the criminal side, since Gideon, we appoint lawyers for serious cases. But on the civil side, the disparity between what we profess and what we do is massive. I think probably greater than any other advanced country, so that folks who can't afford to pay the fare, and that is a very high percentage of Americans, are in effect excluded from the voluntary use of the civil justice system.
And Ashley's case is certainly profound and dramatic. So any kind of medical challenge that you have, a challenge of denial of service, whether it's Medicare or private pay insurance, what are some of the other cases that are involved here, the other kinds of situations people find themselves in, need legal help, can't get it?
Right. There are tons of them. You're right that Ashley's is a miracle, the sort of case that lawyers like to cite for the rest of their careers. And legal aid lawyers across North Carolina are heroic in their efforts. They are underfunded and strapped and of great heart and great skill. But there are tons of other kinds of cases, as you know, massive numbers of foreclosure cases in North Carolina. We just have been doing some work with the Charlotte legal aid community looking at foreclosure cases. And there's a pretty interesting correlation. There are a very large percentage of folks who, if they're in foreclosure and they can get access to a lawyer, they can manage to keep their house or a rework, a loan package and the like. But if they can't get access to a lawyer, which is most of them, then they lose on these fronts almost uniformly. So if you're talking about being able to stay in your house, you're talking about getting unemployment compensation, you're talking about tragic issues of domestic violence and the like, it is quite frequent, it is massively the case across North Carolina that people are denied access to the civil justice system. And it means that they have legal rights that they just have to default on because they can't afford a lawyer.
So maintaining your property is a sort of, I mean, this is about wealth building. You lose that, you're off the charts, right? I mean, you have no chance of participating in the system once you lose piece of the rock. Well, let me ask you, Ashley, how this turned out for you.
Best case scenario, I received the kidney transplant on February 21st of last year. About 4 or 5 days before we were due in court for the appeal, my lawyers received a phone call from Medicaid's lawyers saying they did not want to take the process further. They were dropping the denial, and they were going to approve the transplant. So at that point, I was approved for the surgery. The next step was that we had to get my donor approved because it went from being a cadaveric transplant to a living donor transplant. So we refiled with the living donor material, and at the very last moment, my donor, Jeremy Morris, was approved, and we were able to go through with the surgery.
Time is a very important part of all of this. Tell us about the along the way, the number of decisions that you had to make that would have been pretty impossible without legal help.
I honestly can't count how many decisions. There were sometimes 5, 6, 7 phone calls a day. And this lasted week after week after week from the beginning of the summer of 2010, I believe, or 2011, until 2 weeks before the surgery in 2012.
And in many cases, those phone calls included 24-hour ultimatums, didn't they?
Yes. Yes. In fact, there was one time, and they needed the answer in less than 24 hours, and it had to come from me. They called me. I'd actually just left an appointment, and I was with a friend, and I had to sit down on the side of the road in Chapel Hill and start figuring out how I was going to make this decision. It felt ethically impossible. It felt like a mountain on top of me. And I was very sick and very weak and getting to the point where these type of decisions were, they were taking a toll on my health. So I decided that I couldn't do this one alone. Even though it was my decision, I needed to make it with both my family and my donor family. So I met with my family for dinner and was very apprehensive, trying so hard not to give anything away with my body language or in anything that I was saying to let them know how afraid I was and really how dramatic it was, this one decision on whether or not I was going to live or die. And someone asked me something very simple over dinner, like maybe, do you want any butter? My chin started to tremble, my eyes started to water, and the next thing I knew, I was in tears at this restaurant, very uncomfortable. So we went out into the parking lot. We put my donor family on speakerphone, and together as one large family, we made the decision on whether or not we would continue with the course of action or if we would completely go in an opposite course of action, depending on whether or not I would take dialysis, not take dialysis, whether or not I was susceptible to different infections and how that would affect the outcome of what we were doing.
Charles Holton, there's something about Ashley's story here that suggests something else important about legal aid, how alone she felt. If she can't get professional help and all of these decisions are crashing in on her, even having a hard time talking to her family about it in this condition, when you think about the number of people, I guess, who can't be helped, that it has an impact not only on the outcome of their case, but it seems to me much more profound impact on every other aspect of their life.
It does indeed, and it can affect their, you know, debt situation, their handling their day-to-day responsibilities in other ways. I think legal aid lawyers often see that people come in with one particular problem that's just the tip of the iceberg, and there's really a host of other things going on, and many of them can be addressed legally, some of them are otherwise. But, yeah, that's a part of the issues that these lawyers face.
Who signs up for legal aid? Who are legal aid attorneys?
First of all, attorneys that are committed, they could do other things. We're very proud in North Carolina that we operate legal aid as a big law firm statewide, and we have people who could have jobs in the private sector if they wanted them, but because of their commitment to service in this way, they choose to do this. And they're fine attorneys. I want to emphasize that.
Well, that would have to be a question, and forgive me for asking, but if you have the opportunity, is there a vetting process to make sure that you do have the best attorneys doing this and not attorneys who perhaps couldn't do anything else? Forgive me for asking.
There is indeed a vetting process, and I mentioned operating as a statewide law firm, and I'm a member of a law firm, and indeed there are many similarities with offices spread around the state and significant efforts to coordinate activities, to focus expertise in particular areas and bring in people with that expertise to handle problems wherever they may arise in the state.
So how has funding changed for legal aid?
Well, unfortunately, they've lost about 14% of their funding in the last couple of years. And indeed, if you look back at the level of funding 30 years ago, it hasn't changed much, very little. So they're serving a lot more people with a lot less funds available. But in many ways, they're finding some efficiencies, too, and they're doing a better job of it.
Funding was never much to – I mean, it wasn't high to begin with, Gene.
No, and it's – in real terms, it's dramatically less than it was 30 years ago at the beginning of the Reagan administration. Let me just reiterate something Charles says. I was a law school dean for a long, long time. The competition to get these jobs working in legal services is quite intense. And I think that's something that we ought to be grateful for. You've got you've got idealistic young lawyers who come into this line of work thinking they're going to help folks to better their lives. And so it's sort of a far cry from the circumstance that these are just jobs which go to folks who wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity. They are tremendous young lawyers, and they operate under pressures which a lot of private lawyers don't experience. It's also true, Frank, you know that poverty has risen dramatically in North Carolina since 2008. The number of folks who qualify for legal services has risen. I think it's over 3 million, actually. And at the same time, the legal challenges that they face multiply because when you lose your job, you lose your unemployment, you lose your Medicaid, you're having difficulty in terms of access to school, your family's falling apart. All these legal issues multiply, and there are fewer and fewer resources to assure that they're met. So this is a very large loss for us, a very large departure from what we say. We simply operate a legal system that that goes under the working assumption that very high percentages of folks are going to be priced out from its use. And we've done that for a long time. It is inconsistent with the equal justice that we profess, with the dedication to liberty and justice for all. And what surprised me, I know I'm going past the red here, but when I started studying this 15, 20 years ago, it surprised me that we're such the outlier here. The United States, which is sort of the home of constitutionalism and equal justice, we think, ends up being the worst among the major advanced countries. There's just an international study funded by Gates, the rule of law study, which looks at countries all over the world. It concludes that of the 20 wealthiest nations, we're the worst in terms of access to civil justice. We get the F. And I said, I told a group recently that the study was unfair in a way because it judged you based on what you do rather than what you say. And that puts Americans at a disadvantage. We have the greatest talk in terms of equal justice, but we end up with a system that excludes the most. And as you know, you could say that about aspects of healthcare, about aspects of education and the like. This is a common threat to American equal dignity, but it's multiplied in the legal context, and it has the sort of greater hypocrisy that we promise ourselves equal justice under law.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Gene Nickel, a professor and director of the Center on Poverty Work and Opportunity at UNC's Law School. Charles Holton is the chair of the Board of Directors for Legal Aid North Carolina and an attorney at Womble Carlyle. Thank both of you for being on the program.
Our pleasure.
And Ashley Quinones, a client of Legal Aid North Carolina and doing very well now. Ashley, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we will talk to the president of Duke University's healthcare system. Stay with us.